of their physics class, the fact that I was embarrassed. But I do remember he asked a question about how you played a phonograph record faster to speed it up without changing the pitch. And I was ready to give the answer when some boy said, "You can't do it." And Mr. Smith said, "Right, you can't do it." it's crazy things you remember about class, about subjects. This is pretty far back. I'm trying to remember things.
Should we move on then to, let's go back to your days at Indiana. And you spent 4 years there?
I spent 3 years there. I was still 18 when I had completed the requirements for the degree by the end of the fourth year, first term. But I stayed on the second term, and I was 19 when I graduated. My parents gave me a trip to Europe as a graduation present, and I had 3.5 beautiful months traveling around. I could have hired out as a guide to the Roman Forum after that summer study. And then come September, I went to MIT for graduate work, never having written them that I was coming, never having applied.
Why did you select MIT?
I knew I wanted to stay in scientific work. I didn't know whether I wanted to be a chemist or a chemical engineer. And old Professor Moore in the chemistry department, who was interested, had written a book on the history of chemistry. Somehow or other, I got talking to him, and he went over the differences between chemistry and chemical engineering. Well, this was 1922. Chemical engineering had been in the chemistry department until 1920. But the number of chemical engineering majors was larger than the number of chemistry majors. So it was a very popular subdivision, and when it split off, it was most of the department leaving to become chemical engineering. And Professor Moore told me how able a man Doc Lewis was. That he was a good engineer, but he also was a good chemist. And so I decided to go on in chemical engineering. I should back up a little bit and say that at Indiana in my senior year, my roommate in the fraternity house was Harold Bowen, who was in the business school, and I was a chemistry major and he was a business school major. And he brought home a flyer from the business school, Babston Institute, way out in Massachusetts. Was announcing a national contest, essay contest, and Harold knew I was a good student, and I knew he was a good student, and he knew I was mathematically inclined, and he was not. And I looked at the subjects and I said, analyzing an industry to forecast its activity, that'd be an interesting one. And Harold said, "How'd you like to join me in a contest to do it?" And I said, "Okay." We wrote a three-chapter story on analyzing the industry, and I wrote two of those chapters, and the meat was in the mathematical one. It was a pretty simple analysis, but at the time I thought it was very sophisticated, and I got quite excited about it. We won the first national prize of $500, which $500 at that time was a lot of money. But we had entered it under one name, Bowen's name. I don't think we should have, but we did. We decided that a two-name essay would not be a good thing. Mm-hmm. The Indiana papers all carried a news item on it and identified the two of us as the authors. Well, I came out to, when I came out to Boston to go to MIT, I stayed with one of the Indiana fraternity brothers who was in the business school in the new thing that had separated, had been organized as a separate business school. And while I was there, the word came that I'd won this contest. And my stock certainly went up with the business school boys when they found out I'd been involved in this contest. And for a while, I thought a little bit about going into the Harvard Business School rather than to MIT, but I decided not to. So I go get back to part of the story I left some time ago. I came to MIT not having written them, saying I was coming. And Moore had advised me to go into chem engineering. And the problem was, what did I take? And a professor, Williams, R.S. Williams, later the head of the metallurgy department, but then a professor in chemistry, had the chore of interviewing transfers from other schools and deciding what they had, what it was worth in terms of MIT. And he said, let me have your record. And I said, I don't have one. Well, how do I know you've graduated from Indiana University? Well, you can just take my word for it, and you can ask me questions. Well, do you remember the subjects, books? Of course I do. So he started asking me. And he early put down a list of the things that I must take that I hadn't take. I had to take quantitative organic analysis and some physical chemistry course. And as I talked on, I told him about having taken an electrochemistry course where we made silicon carbide. Set up a little place next to the powerhouse so we could have a few hundred amps straight from the powerhouse. And we had melted sand on a carbon electrode to build ourselves a quartz tube. And he said, I guess I'll cross off. You won't have to take that. I'll let that be a substitute for something. And slowly as I talked, he cut me down so that I had to take almost no chemistry to go ahead. But I was very deficient in other areas. To me, a steam table was something a cafeteria used to keep food warm. I had no engineering background. So I, my first year, and when I got through, he smiled. He said, of course, this is all subject to the fact that we sooner or later get records proving that you've actually been to any university. I just can't imagine MIT ever today allowing anybody to get that far without a written record or a prior admission request. I just assumed I would be admitted. It wasn't a question of requesting admission. I was here. I took a large overload and did well my first year, really was all undergraduate work, chem engineering, thermodynamics. I forget what else. At the end of the first year, I stayed in summer school, and there I met a young man who was just arrived for graduate work from McGill. He was a few months younger than I. It was Tom Sherwood. And Sherwood and I became close friends from then on. And our paths were quite parallel in many respects, as I will later point out. Sherwood and I teamed up on a lab course and did our problems together. We tried to talk Professor Robinson into going off on some problem that we thought was more interesting than the assignment, but he wouldn't buy it. We had to stay with the assignment. Then the second year, I had to do a master's thesis. Well, I had come, I'd said I wanted to be a rubber chemist. So I went to Doc Lewis to see if he had any theses on rubber, and somehow Doc didn't warm up to me at the time. He didn't have anything. Actually, it turned out later he'd not done an awful lot in rubber. He'd written one paper, I guess, and he was a consultant for Goodyear. But Doc's warming up to me didn't occur until several years later. It occurred, but not at that time. And so I got no encouragement to do a thesis with him. And Walter Whitman, then an assistant professor, the assistant director of the Research Lab of Applied Chemistry, the head of which was Haslam, sold me a thesis on, I said I wanted to work on the properties of additives to rubber, like zinc oxide and carbon black, to improve the wear of a tire tread. And he said, fine, why don't you study their effect on the catalysis of the decomposition of hydrogen peroxide. It turned out that he was interested in hydrogen peroxide. And I said, I swear I can't see why I will learn anything about the value of rubber, of zinc oxide or carbon black as an additive to rubber, by studying their catalysis of peroxide decomposition. I think we ought to study the heat of adsorption of organic solvents on these things, solvents or not, heat of adsorption. And he said, okay, if you want to do that, so that's what I did. Made an awful lot more sense than what he had said. Well, this involved very small heat effects, and I found out there was a thing known as a Bunsen calorimeter, which was a tube with a glass bulb around it, fastened at one end, and then at the bottom of the bulb out and up to a capillary. And you had water in this annulus around the inner tube and mercury in the capillary. And you froze a layer of ice on the tube by putting a coolant inside the tube. And then you put in your reaction, your reacting materials, and when they had gotten to zero centigrade, you broke the bulb that one of them was in, and the heat of reaction melted some ice. And you could measure a fraction of a small calorie in this thing. Amazing how the volume change of a tiny bit of ice on a capillary. And you had around the outside tube a bucket of ice, and even put a tiny bit of salt into the bucket on the outside. And you got this so that this thing could sit for 24 hours and not leak over one or two small calories. It was quite an amazing piece of equipment. So I got McAllister Bicknell, before they were their present big company. McAllister blew my glass. I was taking glass blowing lessons from Don Kitchen, a member of the old research lab, but I wasn't good enough to make this gadget, make my calorimeter. So I had finished my calorimeter, my thesis work, by the time we went out to the practice school. I backtrack a little and say that that first summer when Sherwood and I met, we both took a summer course under Haslam on combustion. Robert T. Haslam, the head of the Research Lab of Applied Chemistry, with Whitman really running it, and also the head of the practice school, the successor to R.E. Wilson, who had gone with Standard of Indiana as research director and later become the president of Amoco and then the president of Standard Oil and then chairman of the board of Standard Oil and then an atomic energy commissioner when he died. So Wilson was an important man. Haslam followed him. Both Haslam and Wilson were extremely ambitious people. And maybe this ought to go out later, but I can't resist telling you one story. Wilson and Haslam both, their ego was very high, and Whitman told me the story of a group of them walking back, Lewis and Whitman and Wilson and Haslam, a couple of others. They'd eaten in Walton's restaurant across Mass Avenue, and walking back, Wilson was telling Lewis that he thought it would be nice if the department would issue a volume of his collected papers, and Lewis sidestepped the request and didn't agree to publish Wilson's collected papers, and Wilson made the comment that he guessed there never would again be a record to equal a previous year's record of number of papers published under the name of the Research Lab of Applied Chemistry. And Haslam gritted his teeth walking along with Whitman and said, next year there are going to be more papers published by the Research Lab of Applied Chemistry than this past year if I have to copy them out of the Encyclopedia Britannica. The story is a measure of the extent to which both men would go to win. They were winners. Haslam later became manager of Standard Oil Development Company and then went on the big board as a member of the directory and then the vice president and senior vice president of the big holding company, at which time he retired and was an officer in W.R. Grace for a while before he died. So they both went high in the oil industry. Wilson to the top and Haslam to nearer the top in a bigger outfit. Where was I when I digressed?
Well, you had completed your master's thesis, and that was in chemical engineering? Or was it in chemistry?
It was in chemical engineering. Oh, I...
And then you were going to...
I should... About Haslam, I might... called me in one day and said, Huddle, I just met a man from Indiana who knew you. I was at an ACS meeting, and his name was Mathers, an old professor of yours. And he told me a story about how you were the only one who could sit in the front row of class and go to sleep and answer a question when it was asked. And the reason Haslam told me the story was that I had dozed on him in class, and he, at the end of class, he told me the story. After I completed the practice school, Ryan had been director at the Buffalo station. I had been a test leader, and Tom Sherwood was what was called the log man on the test, in charge of data collection. And when later at the Bangor station he became the test leader, I was his log man. We interchanged positions.
Could you describe something about, you were at all three stations in an 8-week period?
Yes. At that time, the School of Chemical Engineering practice was a much bigger chore than it is today, with no financial support. You were on your own. There was no such thing as support for a master's thesis. So you had to travel to Buffalo. You had to travel up to Bangor, Maine. The third station was in the Boston area, split between the old Merrimack Chemical Company, later bought by Monsanto. Merrimack Chemical Company in Woburn, and the Revere Sugar Refinery. Do you want me to go through the practice school?
If you could go through your experiences with it, yes. You were actually...
At the rate at which we're going, you know, you're going to have two or three more of these cassettes.
Well, that'll be
fine.
I'm
giving you a lot more detail than I probably should have.
No, that's quite all right.
The first station was Buffalo. I got an enormous kick out of the Buffalo station. I didn't yet latch on to my present area of interest, namely combustion and furnace design and radiative heat transfer, which the Buffalo station specialized in. I didn't at that time get it. It was later. But I got a big kick out of the station. Then we went to Bangor, where it was midwinter and everybody's skiing, and nine of us, and only one had ever been on skis. Tom Sherwood had skied in Montreal, McGill, and he was the only one who had skis. So I bought a pair of skis, and that gave the group of nine of us two pairs of skis. I was never any good at it. We had tests on an evaporator. A guy named Osborne, J. Marshall Osborne, and I did a test at the Penobscot Chemical Fiber Company. We were supposed to use, I guess it was electrical conductance, as a measure of concentration in a suspension. And we didn't have anything to work with, so we had to design and build the cells. And if we'd known enough, we'd have known that that was much too big a job to handle in 1 week, to design and build cells that are any good and take data. We built them, the data weren't any good. I call the results that we put into our report, or some MINAR. That's the right name for the Big Bear, the Big Dipper in the sky. It was that was the shape of the curve we got, or Ursa Major, I guess I must have said. I don't remember whether it was Ursa Minor or Minor. They both are Dipper shaped. Ursa Minor, the end of the handle is the North Star. The Big Dipper is not attached. We had very poor instructors at the Bangor station, and I won't mention names, but it was a poor instruction, and there was a system of criticism of each student by the instructing staff at the end of the term. That was part of the term work. And I remember we got together after it was over to compare notes on this criticism, and we decided that our instructors had put some characteristics in a bag and had picked out a piece of paper and said what you are. Because we didn't feel that they had us. In the Woburn station, the School of Chemical Engineering practice was still receiving financial support from money that Arthur D. Little had gotten George Eastman to give MIT, and that meant we had clubhouses at the stations, and the clubhouse always had a woman, one time some of them a couple, and they were very pleasant. The Boston Station clubhouse was in Winchester, and when in Winchester in 1924, I lived in a clubhouse on Church Street. I had no idea that for 40 years, many years later, I would start living in Winchester. I was still going to be a rubber chemist and head for the West as soon as I got through at MIT. At the Woburn station, Harold Weber was the director, and that was a direction of Revere Sugar and also the Merrimack Chemical. Tom Sherwood and I had the job of finding how to make the then fairly new thermal conductivity cells of Leeds and Northrop work in connection with a plant with, I think it was chlorine determination, at an Everett plant. Monsanto already had, Merrimack Chemical already had a plant at Everett. Later on, Monsanto moved everything from Woburn to Everett. But at this time, our station was in connection with the Woburn station. But this project of Tom's and mine was in connection with the Everett station. And it was nothing but a study of the performance of a thermal conductivity cell on a new gas. We got terrible data, non-reproducible data. And then we woke up to the fact that if we put the conductivity cell in a different position, we got different data. And we found out that it was, we'd been having it on a shelf, and the vibration had diddled the wire, and sometimes it was bad and sometimes...